Southwest Southwest. I'm Sibylla Mann. Reporters try not to become the news, but Webb Miller couldn't help it. In 1914, the young newspaper journalist out of Chicago was on assignment when he was assaulted and briefly kidnapped by a well-known businessman. The incident helped to launch Miller on a remarkable career. He became a foreign correspondent, covering events from the Pancho Villa expedition to the Indian independence movement to the Spanish Civil War. He interviewed everyone from Gandhi to Hitler, and he had a cigarette case signed by both.
You can kind of follow world history by following the footprints of Webb Miller.
Steve Arsenault is the director of the Dowagiac Area History Museum. Miller was born on a farm near Pokagon in 1891, and the museum's collection includes photos of him on the job, as well as his old press passes and passports.
I love his passports because he had to get a new one every couple of years because he was always getting them, you know, because he was traveling so often and they had to get canceled, and so he'd have to get a new passport every couple of years.
Arsenault says Miller's reporting, especially his work in India, is still drawing interest. In an interview that first aired in June, we sat down at the museum to discuss how a self-described shy young man with an aversion to violence ended up in journalism, covering executions, then wars, and once finding himself tied up in a salt baron's car. Steve Arsenault, welcome to West Southwest.
Thank you very much for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about Webb Miller's earliest days?
The best information that we have on Webb Miller's earliest days comes from his autobiography, I Found No Peace. And he grew up to an itinerant farm family south of Dowagiac, about halfway between Dowagiac and Niles, near Sumnerville and Pokagon, which was a really just small community between the two cities. And he grew up and he walked to school in Dowagiac. His favorite pastime, according to himself, is was going to the library, getting books. And he details in the book how he, you know, walked uphill both ways through the snow, you know, exaggeration there, but it was a long journey, you know, 7 miles walking to and from town. This had been around the turn of the century, but he was a guy who was always trying to learn.
And like many people at the time, I imagine it sounds like he did a lot of hard work as a kid and as a teenager, a lot of manual labor out in the field.
Well, yeah, as a son of a farm family, I think people can still relate to that today. It is a lot of hard work.
How did he get into journalism?
He was always a guy who was, you know, based upon, you know, reading books and always going to the library. He was a guy who was always trying to learn some new things. And so he just kind of had a early interest in journalism. But living in Dowagiac, the only, you know, the newspaper is a small paper, Dowagiac Daily News. There was a couple of other smaller ones called the Dowagiac Times for a time, and so a few other newspapers, but he couldn't really latch on to them. And he was doing some jobs, I believe at one of the lakes, and he was doing a job and he met a publisher for a Chicago newspaper, and he apparently badgered him enough that the guy offered him a job.
So his journalism career really began in Chicago.
Yes. So his career began at the Chicago American, and he was covering the beat. You know, he was waiting in police stations, waiting for the prostitutes or the murderers to come in, and so he'd cover those types of stories. And I think that he even wrote that it was the underbelly of the American existence that he was covering.
And that would have been in the early 19-teens, and he had some pretty tough assignments as a young reporter.
Yeah, I mean, he was covering executions, and he was a guy who really did not like violence, and he even details in his book how the first time he saw an execution, it made him nauseous, he needed to get out of there, and it's a very understandable emotion that he had.
He'd even been a vegetarian growing up, I think.
Yeah, and he maintained being vegetarian throughout his life.
He did sometimes eat meat, right? He says in the book, I think, that he kind of, you know, he gave in sometimes because it attracted so much attention.
Yeah, that was a funny line that he had in his autobiography, that, yeah, sometimes if you just got tired of answering questions about it, he'd just eat a steak or whatever just to stop the questions.
You can see how, you know, attending an execution might make anybody feel ill, but it seems like he really especially did not like violence, which just makes it interesting that he ended up in the career that he did.
One of his bosses, he asked about that, and his editor at the time said, that's what makes your stories good, is because you don't like it, and you know, it's something that really churns an emotion in you, and that's why your reporting is so good.
So he's reporting in Chicago, and he's not particularly covered in glory at that point. I think they call him a leg man, right? He goes to the event, and then doesn't somebody else actually get to write it up?
Yeah, he's doing some of that, but you know, sometimes he's not really getting bylines. He's what's called a cub reporter, so it's just a kind of just going out there doing the legwork and kind of piecing the information together. But I think it is that Morton Salt story that really propels him to a little bit of notoriety.
Yeah, so tell me about that. In a way, I hate to focus on it because I know he did so many important things and covered so many important stories, but this thing that happened to him, it is noteworthy. So tell me a bit about that.
Morton's daughter eloped and got married, and there was the big story out of Chicago at the time. And
this is Mark Morton, who co-founded Morton Salt?
Yeah, so this is the Morton Salt family. And so every reporter in the city is trying to get this story about the elopement. And so they're all trying to get to, I believe it's Wheaton, Illinois, trying to get to the grounds, trying to get to interview somebody. Eventually, Mark Morton says, if any reporter gets onto my property, we're going to hogtie them and throw them out. You know, I mean, they're going to do some damage to these reporters if they got onto his property. Well, Webb Miller, I guess, viewed it as a challenge, and he went and he got onto the grounds. And when he was discovered, Mark Morton decided to follow through on his threat, and he hogtied him, threw him in the trunk of his vehicle, and took off to take him down to the sheriff at the time.
In the reading the autobiography, the details are really stunning. You know, so he's beaten unconscious. He wakes up, he's tied up, and it sounded as though Mark Morton was trying to get his employees to literally tar and feather Webb Miller, but they wouldn't do it. They were scared. And so then the way Webb Miller tells it, he'd hired a car to get out the property. So when he's leaving the property, having been tied up and he's in the car of Mark Morton and they're driving off and then they get in that accident, you know, Webb had signaled for his driver to follow. So Mark Morton crashes this car in which the kidnapped Webb Miller is tied up, and then they're both cut and bruised, but Mark Morton, leaps out and then commands Webb Miller's own driver to take them onto the police station, which they do, it sounds like. And then I think Webb Miller is arrested.
He is arrested. He's eventually freed, and, no charges are, he doesn't go to jail or anything. But I if my memory serves right, Webb Miller eventually does sue him and receives a pretty small amount of money from the Morton Salt family.
Yeah, it took like a 6 years through the courts or something. It ended up being something of a pittance.
Yes. At least he didn't get tarred and feathered, though.
At least not that. Well, and this did do something for his career.
Yeah, I mean, this is what propels him, kind of gave him a sense of what he could do, and eventually leads to him leaving the Chicago American to freelance down at the borders to cover the Pancho Villa insurrection.
That's the first big international incident that he covers.
It is the first, and I like to say that from that point forward, 1915 is when he goes to the border until his death in 1940. You can kind of follow world history by following the footprints of Webb Miller.
That's the impression that I was getting, too, as I read through this. In fact, it was a bit daunting to even try to put together a list of the events that Webb Miller covered because there's so many of them. They're so high profile, and I'd hate to leave one out. But do you just want to take a stab at that? The outline of Webb Miller's international career?
I'll give it the best shot I can. So when he goes to the border to cover the Pancho Villa insurrection, he's doing a great job getting the stories and working sources, and just really immediately makes an impression on some of those national reporters that are down there at the scene, and he gets a job with the United Press. And from there, after he's got the UP job, then he's sent to Europe to cover World War I, the tail end of the war in Europe, and then he stays in Europe, and he's covering the peace negotiations after the war. He's covering Sinn Féin in Ireland. You know, he's starting to cover Spain because there's the Civil War is already getting started in Spain. He's covering, the big one is in 1930 when he's covering the Gandhi India movement. He covers the Bluebeard execution in France.
An infamous criminal trial in the, late 19-teens or the 1920s. A man who had murdered somewhere like 10 or 11 people, most likely. I mean, sounded like it was all circumstantial, but probably was him. And he's guillotined, and Webb Miller is present for that.
Yeah, that is an incredible one. I mean, that was, it was a mass murder in Paris, who was preying upon widowed women from, you know, their husbands died during the war, and he was marrying them and taking them to his country cottage and executing them. So Webb Miller was covering that, the execution. I mean, this guillotine story is just that they were using it post-World War I is incredible to me. And his description of it is very vivid, and it's just seconds from start to finish, that particular incident. But, you know, he's also covering Olympics in Europe in the 1920s and the 1930s. He's got the Gandhi independence movement. He's covering the Italian invasion of Ethiopia, the Spanish Civil War in the 30s, the other kind of maybe not wartime things, because sometimes he was not covering wars, so that would probably made him feel good. But like the royal wedding when Wallace Simpson, the King of England, abdicated and married Wallace Simpson. He was one of just a handful of journalists who was actually invited to cover that wedding. He covered the King's tour of Canada, and just this amazing array of events that he's covering.
We're speaking with Steve Arsenault, director of the Dowagiac Area History Museum, about the life and distinguished career of journalist Webb Miller, who grew up near Dowagiac.
He got some particular recognition, I think, for his coverage of the Salt March in India. Is that right?
It wasn't really at the time, as today. And I just actually got an email over the weekend from somebody in India who's making a documentary about Gandhi's 150th birthday, and they want pictures of Webb Miller covering it because they recognize today what a profound impact Webb Miller's stories had. So he was the first Western journalist sent over to India to cover this Gandhi independence movement. And the Salt March at Dharasani, which is highlighted in the movie Gandhi, if you've seen the movie Gandhi, he's given this description of the incident as it happens, as these peaceful protesters are being beaten. And it made such an impact that, every newspaper picked up this story across the globe, and they printed out hundreds of thousands of copies of his dispatch that he sent and handed it out in the United States Capitol and other places across the globe. I mean, so it really was one that had an impact at the time. And today we really recognize the deep impact that it had, because it really did change world opinion against the British Empire and what they were doing in India.
Miller's autobiography is so rich in detail. I don't know if you remember the part where he's in London right there at the tail end of World War I, and he's covering it, and he's staying at a not really great hotel or bed and breakfast kind of place, and there's a fish that keeps reappearing at breakfast. Do you happen to remember that?
I don't remember that one.
There's a fish that keeps being served at breakfast, and it's looking awfully familiar. So he writes that he carved his initials on it, and that forced him to finally get a new fish.
Sounds like Webb Miller based upon the other stories that he puts in his book. So while he's doing, covering all this terrible stuff, he does kind of keep a sense of humor about himself, as much as he could. There's the emotion that he put into his dispatches, but he was also successful because he learned a couple of things, and this really comes through in his book, about how he was able to really work sources. He was able to nurture and get sources to open up, and he was able to do that. But then another thing that he was able to do is that we may not recognize it here in the United States that much, but there's a lot of censorship of media that's happened across history. And he was able to sort of bypass a lot of censors and get his dispatches out in places where the governments didn't really want him getting the word out.
When I picked up his autobiography, I found no peace. I expected to encounter someone, a people person, or a sort of pirate, a swashbuckling character. That's not at all how he comes across. Was that your impression as well?
Yeah, that's like an immediate impression that you get, is that this is a guy who is more introspective and didn't like the limelight, and really kind of reluctantly would go on speaking tours if he had to, after he gained some notoriety in the 30s. But he was a guy who really was a pretty shy guy, and he's pretty straightforward about saying that about himself.
He talks about all the work that he had to do to overcome that shyness.
Yeah, maybe that's something that helped him become better at his craft as well. Where if you can't be a shy guy if you want to succeed at journalism, especially at that time, because you really did have to work sources and talk to people, and if you're shy, that you were not going to succeed at his profession.
I was interested that he was so straightforward about this in his book. You could, if you were writing out your autobiography, you have the opportunity to gloss over, but he's saying at various points, even when he's a well-known reporter and he's been in these tough situations, he's been kidnapped and beaten up. He's been in wars. He says he still has to screw up his courage sometimes to go in and interview somebody. He's reminding himself, you've done this before.
Yeah, I guess we all have to do that. You know, like every time school tours, let's say. I remember when I did my first school tour 20 years ago for a museum, and it was just like, you know, I just had to put it in my head that these are fourth graders I'm talking to. I know more than these guys. And so Webb Miller probably, you know, he had to kind of gear up for talking to probably, you know, and he was speaking to some high-profile people, so he had to probably do a lot of homework, you know, research, figure out what the questions are that he was going to ask. And so I suppose that once he got that research done and knew what he needed to ask, he was able to go in there and do the job effectively.
He had a favorite book. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
You can tell by the title of his autobiography, I Found No Peace, that he was not a guy who really relished being sent into war zones. He realized it was part of the job, but he really was a peace-loving guy who grew up in rural southwest Michigan. His favorite book was Henry David Thoreau's Walden Pond, and he always carried a copy of that book around with him all the way up until the day that he fell off of a train and blacked out London.
That brings me to my next question, which is, how did his career end?
So he was covering some parliament hearings in blacked out London and
in 1940,
and they were really hot parliament hearings that he's covering at that time. And he had a cottage outside of the city proper, and he was on the train and he was on his way back to his cottage. The story goes is that the train went past the platform and he stepped out into nothing and fell, hit his head, and died in the fall. Wasn't discovered until the next morning.
Really? He wasn't discovered till the next day?
Yes.
Basically, he died this accidental death, and that, you know, he was in the middle of things. He didn't retire or anything like that.
No, he didn't get to retire and lead a peaceful life that he was hoping to lead. And it's amazing that this guy who essentially, I mean, he was in war zones, dodging bullets from 1915 until 1940. You know, I mean, just in 1939, he's in Helsinki when the Soviets are bombing Helsinki. And he was able to survive all those major incidents, war zones, but he couldn't survive a trip to his cottage in blacked out London.
I was surprised in the book to learn that he had a wife and I think at least one child, because I simply thought, you know, when exactly does he go home? But he did, in fact. He was married.
Yeah, he was married and he had a son, and his son actually went on to become a journalist as well. And he's the one who ended up losing the golden cigarette case that Adolf Hitler and Gandhi and all those people signed.
Yeah, that's right. Webb Miller had a cigarette case that was signed, as you mentioned, by a remarkable and really kind of contradictory group of people.
Yeah, it's an eclectic group of world leaders, from Franklin Roosevelt and Eleanor Roosevelt to Chamberlain from Great Britain, Gandhi, and Adolf Hitler and Mussolini. So all those people etched their names into it. The story goes is that it was his son was in Tripoli, Libya, covering a story because he was also a journalist, and it was stolen from his hotel room, and it's never been seen since. It's probably was just taken as a gold piece, and people didn't realize it probably was melted down shortly thereafter.
Gandhi made him promise not to put cigarettes in it.
Yes, that was the promise, and I believe he said that he kept his promise to it, so.
It would be hard to understate the amount of violence that Webb Miller witnessed, which does make you wonder how somebody keeps himself going. And now he's written about that, and we've talked about that some. But did it have an effect on his worldview? I mean, did it darken his view of humanity, and especially in the 1930s when, you know, it must have just seemed like things were falling apart?
Well, it certainly did. I mean, it's probably impossible for somebody to go through his profession and not be emotionally impacted by it. You can, if you read his autobiography, when you get to that last chapter, he's a guy who's seen it all, and he sees the writing on the wall, and he's dreading what is coming for the next 5 years. And he was absolutely right about what was coming. You know, I mean, that Italian invasion of Ethiopia is, you know, that is the first salvo of World War II. You know, they didn't recognize it at the time, but that was the opening shots of World War II. And it's something that Webb Miller in his book is already dreading, and he knows is coming. And he was kind of mentally gearing himself up for what's to come.
Yeah, I think his book maybe ends with the line, poor human race, something like that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, he is dreading what's in the offing.
You think about how that he died in 1940, you know, and if he'd lived for another decade, all the more that he would have seen, and where would he have ended up there?
Oh, you know, I mean, if he would have seen, you know, nuclear weapons, you know, I mean, I don't know if he would have known how to process that mentally because of just how traumatic that is.
Yeah, bit of an unlikely person to pursue the career that he did. Although he must have been awfully driven. You have the feeling that he's a little queasy all the way through the book, and yet clearly you don't go to all those places and report on all those things if you don't have something in you really propelling you forward.
Yeah, and for a shy guy, you know, I mean, for a person who was as shy as he was, it really takes guts. You know, I mean, you think about how he got started in the journalism, you know, approaching a publisher at a resort in Southwest Michigan, you know, kind of, it's like a cold call essentially. And he, you know, so, I mean, while being a shy guy, he was able to really get the nerve up when he needed to.
Steve Arsenault, thanks so much for your time.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Steve Arsenault is the director of the Dowagiac Area History Museum. In an interview that first aired in June, we met at the museum to talk about journalist Webb Miller, who grew up on a farm near Dowagiac and became a noted foreign correspondent. You can read Miller's autobiography, I Found No Peace, for free online. There's a link at our website. And you can subscribe to WMUK's West Southwest podcast on Apple iTunes and by searching podcasts in Google Music. This is West Southwest. I'm Sevilla Mann.